Good morning. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the lay chaplaincy program. It was started in the early 1970s by our Canadian father of Unitarianism, the Reverend Philip Hewitt. He proposed that suitable individuals in Unitarian congregations be trained to conduct personalized ceremonies for people living in the community, here, Greater Victoria. Ceremonies for the great unchurched, you might say. Those who would describe themselves perhaps as spiritual, but not religious. It was agreed that there would be three primary purposes to the program. The first is basically to provide a much-needed and high-quality service to citizens in our community, a custom-designed ceremony to mark a significant passage in an individual's or a family's life. Secondly, we act as ambassadors for our religion, as we are in a unique position to tell people about our faith. I have yet to conduct a service where someone hasn't engaged me in a conversation about Unitarianism. And the third purpose is to provide for the spiritual development of the lay chaplains themselves. And this it truly does through the rich experience of being present with people as they mark significant events in their lives. During my time as a lay chaplain, I have discovered that there are several myths lurking about, and I would like to address each one of these in turn. Myth number one, you have to be a woman. Now, you could be forgiven if you think that this is true, but the fact is, men are truly welcome to consider this role. Indeed, Peter Scales is a lay chaplain with the Capital Congregation, and I'm sure he would be happy to share his male perspective with any of you who are interested. Myth number two, you have to sing in the choir. Now, fortunately, Joyce's presence as a lay chaplain has helped to put this myth to rest. But for a time, all the lay chaplains were members of the choir. There was Pam and Jan and myself. But that was just a happy coincidence. You can rest assured that the selection process does not involve a singing audition. Myth number three, one has to be asked to be a lay chaplain. Not so. People who are interested in becoming a lay chaplain are always welcome to join the committee and find out more about the role. When the time comes to find a successor for a retiring lay chaplain, the position is advertised, people are invited to complete an expression of interest, and a selection committee, which includes the minister, interviews and chooses the best person for the job. The recommendation of the selection committee goes to the board, and ultimately, it's the congregation that approves the appointment. The bottom line is, we serve at your pleasure. Myth number four, the ceremonies we conduct take place at the church. Well, from a fundraising point of view, it would be great, from revenue thinking, it would be great if this were so, but alas, most couples have already chosen their venues by the time they come to us. So typically, it doesn't work to promote the use of our beautiful space. As Joyce will share with you, we end up conducting ceremonies in some very interesting places. Myth number five, we make the big bucks, or it's a great way to supplement your retirement income. Oh, were it only so. The fee for most of the services we offer is $300, and $100 of that goes to the church. So we make $200 for most ceremonies, And the number of ceremonies we do in any given year can vary from 10 to 20. With interviews, preparation time, email exchanges, rehearsals, and the ceremony itself, we don't dare work out the hourly rate. Indeed, one of the criteria for lay chaplaincy is that the lay chaplain have another source of income, and that lay chaplaincy is not meant to provide a significant addition to that income. Eliminating the money-making incentive from the role ensures that we can work easily with one another in sharing ceremonies and need not worry about one of us needing the money. Myth number 6, we assist the co-ministers to do their job. As I said early on, we have been trained to conduct ceremonies. That's it. That's all, folks. So the myriad of ministerial duties, such as preparing and delivering sermons, pastoral care, assisting in the church's administration, all these and many other duties we leave in the capable hands of Reverend Shauna and Melora. Where we can be of assistance is if the co-ministers are unable to conduct a ceremony, for example, a memorial service for a member of the congregation. Then we would be honored to do so. You may recall that before Reverend Shauna and Melora were settled here, we lay chaplains did conduct several memorial services for members of this congregation who died during that interim year. But typically, members of our church in need of a ceremony of any sort are able to call on their co-ministers to perform it. It's one of the benefits of membership. Myth number 7, we are busy every single weekend. Well, while it can get quite busy in the summer wedding season and occupy many of our weekends in July and August, there is much less traffic for our services during the rest of the year. Other than during the 2 summer months, it is not a problem to make weekend plans or be away. With 3 of us in this role, we can share requests and balance our lay chaplaincy workload with the other commitments of our lives. So those are the myths I understand. Now here's the nuts and bolts of what really happens. Ultimately, lay chaplains serve the community of Greater Victoria on behalf of their congregation. And this is in accordance with rules outlined by the Canadian Unitarian Council. The recruitment and selection process here at First is guided by a panel, which, as I said, includes the minister and a current lay chaplain and other individuals, perhaps from the Human Resources Committee. Advertising an upcoming vacancy happens in the year before the lay chaplain is scheduled to retire. And just for the record, I'm the first of we 3 who will be stepping down. My 6-year term ends in the fall of 2013. So in 2012, this year, we will be beginning the search for my replacement. So please take note, any of you who think this might be the next step on your spiritual journey. Talk to any of us for more details about both the recruitment process and the role itself. There are some basic criteria that must be met. You must be a member of this church, actively involved with the congregation, have a working knowledge of Unitarian history, principles, and purposes, able to meet the time demands of the position. As I said, it's a 6-year term, and much of the demand is in the summer months. You have good public speaking skills, sound judgment, you listen well and are compassionate, you have organizational skills, and are adaptable and flexible. These last 2 are important because even the best laid plans or meticulously designed ceremonies can go astray. and the role of the lay chaplain is to inject contagious calm into the situation. You are willing and able to attend training sessions and be a lay chaplain in training prior to your formal appointment as a lay chaplain. Let me say a little bit more about this lay chaplain in training role. At first, here, during the retiring lay chaplain's last year, the lay chaplain in training has an opportunity to shadow me and the other lay chaplains as we perform the job. This includes going to interviews with couples and families, attending rehearsals and ceremonies, and participating in training sessions offered by the CUC. The goal of the one-year training period is to ensure that the up-and-coming lay chaplain is well prepared and comfortable in stepping into the role. Those who have completed an expression of interest and meet all the criteria above will be interviewed by a panel and who makes its recommendation to the board for the individual to be appointed a lay chaplain in training. Upon approval, the board's decision is brought to a congregational meeting for ratification. Assuming a successful year as a lay chaplain in training, the same process of ratification by the congregation takes place to appoint the lay chaplain. The CUC takes care of licensing details with the provincial government to ensure that the marriages we perform are legal, and a contract is signed between the lay chaplain and the president of this congregation, which outlines the duties of both parties. The key point to note here is that you, our congregation, ratifies our appointment. And for that, we thank you. It is an honor to serve our community on your behalf.
I'm going to give an introduction to the places we go to, the people that we meet, and other related duties. Lay chaplains officiate at all manner of services, such as home blessings, pet ceremonies, renewal of vows, etc. But today I will focus on the three most common ceremonies: child naming, celebration of life, and weddings. A child naming ceremony is a rare event. I have only done one in the 3 years that I've been a lay chaplain. And this goes for traditional churches too. Young parents are reluctant to hold a naming ceremony for their babies or children. Our memorial services are very well received. And we experience the greatest satisfaction when we are able to assist a family in planning a service that is both personal and meaningful for them. We officiate at local funeral homes, memorial gardens, and the Kiwanis activity room. Weddings are our principal outreach service, and each year, am I not doing this right? My personal technician. Weddings are our principal outreach service, and each year, for some reason, one date is in high demand. This year, it's August the 11th. We don't know why. Most traditional churches will only marry within the church buildings, and couples come to us because they want outside weddings, and they have a variety of choices, and these included in private homes too, ranging from small condos, rustic cabins, Shaughnessy mansions. Exclusive hotels and resorts, and even the Coho Ferry. The art gallery, the Jubilee Chapel Garden, the chapel and its roof garden. St. Anne's Academy and Uvic Interfaith Chapel. Vancouver Island wineries, Saanich fairgrounds, sports arenas, golf or yacht clubs, Parks have included Goldstream Park and Sachs Point Park. And usually the weather cooperates, but we have experienced heavy winds and rain downpours. To be married on the beach sounds so romantic. And it often is, unless the tide is rapidly coming in. And the lay chaplain wonders whether the service will be completed before the waves have lashed against them. Conversely, the tide may be well out, and the couple wish to be married at the water's edge. And here I quote Fran, who said, "The wedding party walked in sloopy, goopy mud." Isn't that a lovely phrase? Sloopy, goopy mud to the water site. At my interview with one couple, the first question the groom asked me was, "How agile are you?" To which I replied, "How agile do you want me to be?" And they said they wanted to be married down by the river, but to get there we had to walk down a deep, rough pathway, which we did, with again the rain blessing us on our heads. We have officiated with only 5 people present, which is the legal requirement, and over 200. We are adaptable. We are flexible. The people whom we marry, our referrals come from our website, personal referrals, and couples will tell us, as Fran has mentioned, that they are spiritual and not religious. Sometimes we're chosen because the couple are of mixed faith or of ethnic backgrounds. We have married couples who have combinations, have been either Jewish, Catholic, Muslim, Protestant, Sikh, pagan, humanist, or atheist. We have co-officiated with their Catholic priest or the Anglican priest, a Druid priest, and a Sikh leader. I'll close with other related duties. Clearing the snow away from the church path. Coaxing the staff of a high-end restaurant to clear away the goose droppings from the bridal path. Freezing and storing the wedding cake until the couple returns to Victoria 2 years later. Victoria is a popular destination wedding, and some couples have arrived with no witnesses or even a venue. And Liz put on a wedding in her home, provided witnesses, cake, flowers, and wine, and even designated Mike as the official photographer. Oh, the places we go to and the people we meet. We sally forth, ever mindful that we are representing our faith and you, our congregation. We want to make you proud. Thank you for the opportunity, the privilege, and the pleasure of serving you as one of the lay chaplains.
So, what happens when the phone rings or we get an email asking for our services? My job today is to tell you about the nuts and bolts of our work, how we go about doing memorials and weddings, how we get from hello to so be it. When I attended the lay chaplaincy training course, the instructor said that while weddings and child dedications were wonderful, we would find memorial services the most richly rewarding work. I didn't believe them, but I certainly do now. We all do. Often, when we're called upon to perform a memorial service, we have very little time to prepare, as little as 48 hours. So we quite simply drop everything and go. These services are usually performed for people we have never met. So it is vital for us to get a feel for who they were, who the family members are, what their views of life and death are, and what they expect the service to do for them. We want to meet with as many of the close family as we can and hear their stories. The interview with the grieving family is crucial to giving them the service they need. We go equipped with questions, with readings, with an outline of the service, with elements of ritual, and with our calming and caring selves. Obviously, we're working in a sensitive area where feelings may be very fresh. They may be raw, or they may be conflicted. It is our job to be the one person who is calm and in control, for that will be the gift that we can give the family. We will take care of the ceremony, and they can do their grieving. Part of their grieving process may be to choose the readings and write the eulogy, but just as often they may wish that to be our job. Once we have this information we need, we go home and create the service, pulling together pieces from our resources and from our experience. We send them our draft, they suggest changes or not, and we're ready to go. We arrive at the service early to make sure that the space is set up properly and that candles, flowers, pictures, music, etc. are all arranged. We take care of the family before the service and stay afterward to talk with the guests. During the service itself, our skills are called upon to make it a safe place to tell and hear stories about the deceased, to hear of the joy and woe that we just sang about, to allow for the tears and laughter, to help people find a way to carry on. It's amazing to hear the stories of a life that has passed and its effect on the living. We've all been to memorial services where we've come away saying, I didn't know that about so-and-so. I wish I'd had an opportunity to talk with them about it. There was great hilarity at one of my memorials when a speaker asked, so, have any of you here ever driven with Chris? She was a famously speedy driver. Most people took her offer of a ride only once. It was good to laugh. At another service, with only close family present, a niece told of an extraordinarily kind thing the deceased had done for her and asked to keep secret. She asked permission of her deceased uncle to tell at this point, and we were all moved beyond words when she did. At these services, we go in knowing nothing and come away with a deep sense of loss just the same. The other main part of a chaplain's job is performing weddings. So what do you think the last thing people getting married think about? A couple of years ago, we had a booth at the local bridal fair. Our table was set under a sign that said, "Can we marry you?" The number of brides who saw that sign and went, they, among all the preparations for the venues, flowers, dresses, menus, photographers, cakes, they'd forgotten they needed an officiant. As my friend Pam here says, Fran here says, without us, it's just a party. Wedding preparation is an entirely different matter from memorials. Most couples who contact us are working well in advance of the date. We may get a call a year in advance, but then sometimes it's just a month. The first step in preparing to perform a wedding is the same as with a memorial service. Meet the client. We offer to meet at their home, a coffee shop, in our homes. Usually they choose to come to me. And over tea and a cookie, we get to know each other. Then I accept a booking fee, which guarantees the date. August the 11th is really, really full. And then we get to business. We find out about the couple's dreams for their ceremony, how many attendants they're going to have, how many parents they have, what color are the dresses, who will walk down the aisle with whom, what music will be playing, and how formal do they want it to be. We also find out what the pitfalls they are that they anticipate. Will the flower girl have learned to walk by then? True. Will the divorced parents sit on the same side of the aisle? Will the bossy aunt try to take over? This is all the real stuff of families and weddings. And then we get to the words. Weddings these days are not the way they were years ago. No longer does the couple expect their ceremony to be just the way their parents were. All our couples are looking for something unique. Couples choose us because we are flexible. We do not have a prescribed set of words like the marriage commissioners or some religions. We do not marry the couple. We say they marry each other, and we facilitate that. And so the ceremony must reflect who the couple truly are. The lay chaplains with our church, from this church with our committee have put together a 45-page booklet, with myriad choices for wedding ceremonies. This forms the basis of our ceremony planning. We have the basics, the opening words, the vows, the ring exchanges, etc. But we also have hand fastings, sand ceremonies, candle lightings, wine ceremonies, and all manner of interesting ways to get married. There are practically no limits. Practically. We send the couple off with the booklet and suggest that they email us with their choices, and if they find something somewhere else, we're happy to incorporate it. And then we wait. And then we wait. I like to set a second appointment at the first meeting, which sometimes helps. We encourage people to make their choices early before they get swamped with the last-minute details. But finally, the choices are made, and we weave the parts together into a smooth ceremony and send it back to the couple for their edits and approval. A couple of weeks in advance, we receive the final payment and the marriage license. We fill out the forms, print out a copy of the ceremony for ourselves and one for them as a keepsake, make a fancy certificate for them to frame if they like. That's what we call value added. We hold a rehearsal, usually the day before, so everyone is sure who stands where and everyone feels comfortable with each other in the space. Recently, I married a couple who had 3 children. They were ages 7 and 4-year-old twins. I was concerned that the kids would feel awkward leading the processional and standing in front, so I made a special effort to connect with them. It worked too well. At the wedding, they decided to stand right next to me. The bride and groom were way out in the wings. But that was okay by everybody because, after all, we were marrying the whole family. On the wedding day, we arrive early at the venue to make sure everything's in order. We calm bridal nerves, or grooms. My first bride was very nervous and offered me a dime if I could make her laugh. I did, but I didn't tell her I was likely more nervous than she was, and I don't think she ever knows it was my first wedding. We make sure the paperwork is in order and that the pen works. The supply of Kleenex is good. You see, I have Kleenex here in my binder. Often you need that between the vows and the ring exchange, for the groom often. We chat with the photographer and we discuss how they're going to work, and we hope that's going to be unobtrusively. At the appointed hour, we check with the bride, make sure she's ready to go. We get the groom into position, and then it's cue the music, and we're off. Many of the couples that we marry go on to have babies. And we would love to perform their child dedication ceremonies, but not nearly enough of them call on us for that. We have so many stories to tell of our adventures in lay chaplaincy. However, we're bound to keep most of what we do confidential. The 3 of us get together regularly to share stories and a meal and a beverage. It's a great support to be able to share this way. And I think we all feel that this is the best job we've ever had. And we only have it for such a short time. 6 years used to sound like a long time. It's very short. And so we'd like you to think whether lay chaplaincy might be in part of the next phase of your life. So be it.